From the hills of central New York and the heart of the Finger Lakes, this is Frankly Speaking. I'm your host, Frank Rossi. My guest on the final episode of our 11th season of Frankly Speaking is a local here to the Finger Lakes, Odessa's own Russ Myers, the Director of Agronomics for Hance Golf Course Design, where he works with frequent contributors to this program, Gil Hance and the inimitable Jim Wagner. Russ and I share the education from Cobleskill, New York, mentored by the legendary Bob Emmons. Raised in a coaching family, Russ has served as an assistant in training at Augusta National, superintendent at the Card Sound Golf Club, the director of agronomy at LA Country Club, and two stints at Southern Hills. Russ spent his career building teams and striving for precision. Precision matters when delivering plant nutrients efficiently, and that is what the Plant Food Company is all about. Plant Food Company's line of products are designed and tested to meet the nutrient needs of your plants without waste or loss to the environment, making them a sustainable choice. Contact your plant food rep or visit plantfoodcompany.com. Welcome to Frankly Speaking, Russ Myers. It's such a treat to have a local, right? The hills of central New York, heart of the Finger Lakes. You are, in fact, one of the few that I get to talk to that is a native of this area, Russ. You spent your early years here in the Finger Lakes. Talk about that, and then we'll get into your interest in sports and how it might have led to your golf course career.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Odessa, New York. My father was, athletic director, school teacher, coach. His family ran a place in Horseheads, New York called the Casablanca and Fred's Fun Center. And so I deep roots to that part of town. I did basketball camps at Barton Hall and football games at Schoolcraft Field. And yeah, it was all ag country of upstate New York and all the way through until I ended up at Cobleskill and made my way down to Georgia and kind of have never been back ever since. I mean, I've been back, but I kind of moved on.
That's right. Okay, so let's deconstruct that a little bit. Sounds like you actually did some basketball coaching at Cobleskill. So how come coaching itself, like a lot of us in this business, Russ, I love being around sports and I've gotten to be around golf and all kinds of sports over the years. How come you didn't just pursue coaching?
The truth of that answer is when I went to college, I just decided I wanted to try something different. I loved sports, loved every bit of my childhood around sports with my father. I felt like I knew probably more than I really did about coaching, and I felt like I would have been a good coach, but I felt like I had done it for 18 years. I had lived that life, and I said to myself, if I'm ever going to do something different, I kind of need to do that through school. And didn't choose turf. Frankly, didn't know what I wanted to do. Yeah. In Odessa, New York, Montour Falls, Watkins Glen, the most successful person in our neighborhood was the guy who ran the pharmacy down in Montour, right? So that was what we aspired to. And I actually looked at pharmacy for a school, applied to a lot of schools, got accepted to, I think, every place I applied to except maybe West Point, which probably did me a favor. I don't know if I'd have been able to handle that, but didn't know what I wanted to do. But I knew I wanted to go south and experience south for some. So I had done a camp for golf the year before at a small school in North Carolina called Methodist College, which most golf industry know is a pretty good golf school. And I went down there for a semester and it wasn't really clicking. I didn't like to practice golf as much as the really good players did. It was quite apparent to me. So my dad kind of said, well, don't waste the money if you're not going to get into it. And he said, why don't you just enroll up at Corning for a semester until you figure it out? Yeah. Well, I did a pretty good job of not going to class at Corning. And I made every effort to unwind my educational success prior to that. I mean, I was a pretty good high school student. I didn't work very hard at it, but I did really well and had all the opportunities. But I couldn't figure out what I wanted to do. And the story's been told a few times, but Watkins Glen Golf Club, I'm sure we'll talk about it, but 9-hole public course on Seneca Lake, Greg Kuhn running the place. And I started working there as a summer job. And I'm in the clubhouse one day with the then club champ, played in the member guest with his partner. They would win it almost every year. And he said to me, why don't you go to Cobleskill? And I said, well, why the hell would I go to Cobleskill? I don't even know where that is. And he said, well, they got a degree for what you do. And I said, well, what do I do? He said, golf course maintenance. I said, what are you talking about? He said, yeah, my partner and the member guest, Bob, he's a superintendent down at Nichols Country Club. I said, really? Yeah. So I don't know if cell phones were even used then, right? You didn't have the internet to grab on your phone.
And you're talking about Bobby Taylor.
Yeah, Bob Taylor.
This is so great. I got to have my brother-in-law listen to my podcast. He was friends with Bobby. I don't think Bobby's at Nichols anymore.
Yeah. No. I think Bobby's retired. I think he's down with Roger Olmsted down in North Carolina, just retirement working with him, if I understand it right. So I'm like, whatever. So again, the good fortune of my father and being at the school and having the keys to the school, I grabbed his keys in the summer and I went up to the guidance office and grabbed a brochure off the counter. And my recollection is we applied. I don't even know that I ever visited it. And I enrolled in Cobleskill. And next thing you know, I met Bob Evans and Craig Courier and all these guys, right? And so I said I wasn't going to play sports. I mean, I wasn't a Division I athlete here, let's be fair, but I was a decent golfer. I understood basketball, could play the game. About halfway through that freshman year, my first year at Cobleskill, it would technically have been my sophomore year, but they were a two-year athletic institution, and they had a four-year degree in turf. Mm-hmm. Well, I was playing like intramurals basketball or something, and the basketball coach saw me and asked me if I wanted to come to the practices. And I started going to the practices. And he got me to play the second half of that year. Now, we weren't very good.
Well, if you weren't on the lacrosse team at Cobleskill, you weren't really good at anything.
but it's funny. So I finished that year. The end of it was kind of frustrating. I remember going down to Hudson Valley area and getting dunked on like four times late in the game. And guys, we weren't really playing hard. And I was like, yeah, this is why I didn't want to do it, right? And I kind of finished that year and said, all right, I'm done. I'm not doing it again. Well, Cobleskill hired a new coach in that offseason who came in from Chicago, a really strong program. And one day I was looking through the doors and I was watching their practice and they were just getting after it. I mean, physical, intense. And I made a comment to my dad. I said, boy, this new coach really gets after it. And that was kind of it, right? And I was now old enough to have a beer. I was living off campus and I was enjoying my beers, you know. And unbeknownst to me, I get this call one day. I'm literally 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm having a beer on my couch. I get a call from the basketball coach of the college. And he says, hey, Russ, I talked to your dad. I was recruiting a young man from Odessa by the name of Charlie Wood, who was a great friend of mine, right? And he said, I was talking to your dad, and I didn't realize you were here. We lost some kids. He didn't get to recruit anybody in there that year. He had all walk-ons. He said, we lost some kids to grades, and we're struggling to field a practice. Would you be willing to come practice with us? And I was like, yeah, sure, coach. I'd like to get a workout. I'm pretty out of shape, though, And I said, when do you want me to start? And I took a drink of my beer, and he goes, well, practice is at 3 o'clock. And I went, okay, all right, I'll see you there. Well, this guy really inspired me. I mean, that team was a good team. They weren't a heavily talented team, but you knew that all five guys on the floor were playing hard. Huh. They competed. They won a lot of games. They made it to regionals. And it was a special bond that got me re-inspired into sports. And he tried to get me, so I had another year at the school, but I didn't have any eligibility. So he asked me to come coach with him, and I did. Yeah. And then he tried to get me to do a graduate assistantship after my last year. And he was going to get me set up with Raleigh Massimino when he was at Cleveland State. Mm-hmm. Well, I didn't know if it was going to come through. So in the meantime, I sent these resumes out to Augusta National and Shinnecock and Pebble Beach and somewhere else, right? Just in case I needed a summer job. Our friend Jim Hengel, I had done an internship for him. He had reached out to Augusta. He knew I did it. So he reached out and put a word in for me. And next thing you know, I got a call to Augusta. And I was like, well, I got to go take this $6 an hour job at Augusta over, And so that's kind of how it went. And frankly, I still love basketball. I still love coaching it. But it's been this bridge that I've walked, mostly just about experiencing new things, which I think will define what I'm doing now.
Well, right? And that's the thing I would say now. Okay, so I'm so glad you took a minute to actually describe some of, in pretty good detail, I would say, about your passion for coaching. Because when you read articles about you, and of course, I got to know you, I think I knew of you. We probably knew of each other way before we actually met. And then I remember you showing up to the Open in 02 when Craig was doing it at Bethpage. And, here you were. Hey, Russ, finally we meet. And, you're out rolling and doing it. And it turned out, this was something that also became a passion for you during tournaments. But what was really obvious is that you sort of had this. When I watched you interact with people, Craig put you right in charge of a bunch of things. And I saw you rally a bunch of kids. And I'm like, wow, this guy sort of can gather people up and do things. And it seems like, Russ, you still do coach. You just sort of do it in a golf course crew. And I guess I don't want to get all the way to the end, but now you know, you're not working in that crew environment anymore. So are you coaching up Gil and Jim a little bit, or the cavemen a little bit, or where are you getting your coaching fix these days?
Boy, that's a great question. You hit it on the head. I mean, my view of what I've always done has not been that I'm the most talented nutrition guy or science or whatever, but I know who to call and I know how to gather information. And I think if I'm given the accurate information and the right pieces, we'll make good decisions and we'll solve problems. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's coaching, right? You're going to take the talent you've got and you're going to try to figure out how to maximize it and just get better each day. When it comes to Gil and Jim, I've probably spent the first 14, 15 months trying to understand the assumptions of the operation, trying to understand how they think about things. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not anointed the leader of that operation. It's Gil Hance. And when Gil's not talking, it's definitely Jim Wagner, right? So, you know, Jim, he's a little offended that you didn't invite him onto this call.
No,
he said he
so
didn't think
great.
He could handle it.
Can't wait till he hears this. And I'm so much better now than I was when I interviewed him.
Yeah. So you've got a whole group of talented guys who are each have their own expertises that they know they can do well. And right now, I spend as much time trying to understand the different viewpoints and figure out how to just kind of tugboat the ship a certain way. It's not going any farther than Gil and Jim. It's wherever they want it to be. It's just to try to figure out how to make their lives easier by taking some of the time that's unnecessary for them to be involved in away from them by working with the rest of the team to make sure we're on the same page to maybe simplify their lives. Mm-hmm. And when we do it well, it's rewarding. Mm-hmm. When we don't, it's frustrating.
And you don't have to wonder if you're not doing it well with Wagner. So listen, we're going to get back to what you're doing now, but we got a few more minutes in this first part. And I want to go back to, you know, you're at Cobleskill like me, you meet Bob Emmons, and, you know, to this day, he's the guy, right? He's the guy that had that calming, steady voice, you know, was giving me at the time when there was a booming. I mean, I graduated in 1982, Russ. You're a whole decade later than me, right? Yeah, so we had, you know, it was only 2 years when I was there. But let's go back. You get this gig, you make this choice, you go to Augusta. You stayed at Augusta. Let's deconstruct it a little bit, because obviously your pedigree has mattered, because it's, you know, obviously developed for your entire career. Augusta National and Watkins Glen, Greg Koons's 9-hole, you know, side hill layout, you know, whatever's going on there, around buildings, up and over trees, through woods. Obviously, the quality of the place has gone up dramatically over the years. I've gotten to see it. So you go from that. Now you got a gig at Augusta. Your eyes must be just bugging out, like it can't even be real grass when you get there compared to what you'd seen before that.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt. Look, I didn't mow my own yard growing up. I was the least ag-oriented individual in Schuyler County, right? I was in a gym all the time. So I didn't go there with any great expertise. I didn't grow up on a farm. I spent time on a farm, but it was to hang out with my friends and shoot baskets in between them milking the cows, you know? So I get down there, and to me, it relates back to the coaching. I always said, and I wasn't a Celtics fan, but growing up, every kid wanted to be Larry Bird or wanted to be Michael Jordan. And I wasn't going to be that. So what was the, how could I be Larry Bird adjacent? You know, how could I be there? And it was being a part of those organizations. And to me, that was, you know, I was young, didn't have any massive burdens. And what was it going to hurt for me to go be a part of that and see what it's about? Mm. I loved it there. I had 4 incredible years there. Life moments, evolutions. I mean, I could still be there in some respect. Like I looked at certain jobs, got offered great opportunities as really good assistant jobs from there that I turned away because when I left the interviews, I could just tell I still would rather be at Augusta. Mm. And it was about knowing that your work was being evaluated on a world stage all the time was a really cool opportunity. Even though I wasn't Brad Owen, I wasn't Marsh Benson, I was a part of that, and it mattered to me.
So here's the other part. I want to wrap this up because I think there's an interesting corollary here. Augusta's one of those places, you know, that most of us from the outside, I remember talking to Emmons about it early on when I was thinking about going or doing things. It wasn't Augusta was what it is today. In the 80s, it was Augusta, but it was a different deal. And there was this sense that you had to be very detail-oriented and work with a sense of urgency. And this, as many as you know, and everybody, a lot of our listeners know, there's a grind to this business. Now, I think some people take it to excess, right? Just to say that there's a grind to it. But when you go to a place like Augusta on the stage to a very demanding clientele, at least for a period of time, it's a grind. You know, I've hired a lot of athletes over the years, Russ. And one of the things I find about athletes that I've recruited into turf over the years is, man, they're used to disciplined, grinding, intense, 7 days a week, no other life but your sport. And I'm wondering if you weren't set up well to work in that sort of environment and that made you well-suited for Augusta and then the grind that you pursued in construction and design, you know, construction and maintenance stuff that you did at a number of properties. What about the grind?
Yeah, it's interesting because this is going to come off wrong, but of every operation I've been a party to, I never found Augusta's maintenance operation to be at a different level of grind or maintenance talents to any other operation I've been in. And that's not a discredit to them. They run a very traditional operation, but the fact of the matter is, where do you put the priority, right? And you have to put the task first. To your point, people grind at courses all over the world. The difference with Augusta is they will create enough people to be able to accomplish those grinds. You just have to put them first. To my mother's chagrin, I spent many a Christmas holidays working, right? I was the one who stayed to watch the course that day. You know, it wasn't that hard, but you had to sacrifice to be there. I mean, I was the only one there, so I had to go check the pump stations. I grabbed my clubs. I went and played. I actually took a nap in the 13th fairway one Christmas. It was really nice. So it's not like it was a grind physically, but it's a mental commitment that says, are you trying to get better? And are you doing, you can't just say, well, you know, we're not going to check that today. We're not going to make sure that heads went down tonight. And because I don't feel like going out there at 2 a.m. You have to make the commitment to it. So it's to athletic endeavor. You would say, I don't want to work out today. Well, if you're going to be Michael Jordan, you're going to be Larry Bird, you get up and you go work out, right? It's nothing you can't do. It's nothing that's not being done at every golf course across America. The question is, are you committed to it to that level? And they set that standard. And let's go back to that team I played on. I love playing basketball for my father. And I told him once, the best thing about playing for that team the second year at Cobleskill was you knew every other guy on the floor with you was playing just as hard. Yeah. And I think that's all you want to create in a work environment is where you're not looking around going, no matter how hard I try, this person over here is going to let us down. And if you can create that environment where people meet those standards, it doesn't matter what you're in, you've got a team that's working for a common goal, you're going to be all right, you know? So I think that's how it all interrelates for me.
I couldn't agree more. And Russ, we have made a mental commitment, you and I, to finish this conversation, which we're going to do in a couple of more segments after this message from our sponsors. I'm with Russ Myers of Hans Golf Course Design. This is Frank Rossi. Frankly Speaking, we'll be right back. Efficient golf course operations rely on a functional and healthy soil. Dryject Services offers the right balance of water injection cultivation, but by injecting with sand and minimal disruption with maximum sand yield. If your soils need some amending and you could use a little less disruption, then Dryject Services are for you. Learn more about the tailored services Dryject can provide by contacting your Dryject rep or visiting dryject.com. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I am already enjoying this conversation, Russ, and we're just getting started. And I want to talk a little bit about what you said a minute ago when, you know, you were at Augusta and, you know, you were really enjoying it. And as you said, you know, it's a good time in your life to be doing it. So then, as I recall, because I think you hired a Cornell alum, Andy Sliwa, for a winter, looking for some work on the side, you were at Cardstown Golf Club. Was that the first place after Augusta? And then was it just time to go by then for you after 4 years there?
No, it's funny. You talk about Cornell grads. The first one I worked with was actually at Augusta. It was Dr. Michael Woods.
Yeah, that's right.
I trained Micah on ham, water, and greens.
Good thing you met him back then to straighten him out.
Yeah, I don't think he's changed much. So I was rolling along. And again, as long as I had enough money to go eat my filet steak and have a few beers at night and enjoyed my work, I wasn't really looking for change. I was an assistant in training at Augusta. The real story is that there had been, when Brad became the superintendent, you know, it was his first run at being the super there. And there was, so that opened up his spot. I was still pretty young. I was like 23 at the time, I think. And, you know, I probably believed that I could handle that role. I think it would have been a stretch for Brad to put me in it at that time. You know, look at the club and say, yeah, I'm going to bring this 23-year-old into the role that he just left after 14 years. Mm-hmm. So there wasn't really a role for me. And they brought a friend of mine back to that role. And I didn't love it at first. I kind of, you know, as with anything, you wished you had the opportunity.
Yeah.
But I accepted it too. And I understood it. Didn't have a problem with it. And I just kept doing my job. Well, others were more unhappy about it than me.
Hmm.
One of which was former Augusta employee, great friend of mine, mentor, Matt Schaefer, who at the time was at the country club of Pepper Pike. And Matt felt strongly that I needed to move on and do something. And he was helping a group that was doing some placement, and they had a connection with this club in Key Largo. And he called me and wanted me to go look at this job. And I said, Matt, I want to be at a classic championship facility. You know, I don't want to just go to a golf course in Florida. Those places don't exist in Florida. And he kept pressing me to go look at it. And I said, I'm not going, because when I turn the job down, when I turn it down, if they offer it to me. And by the way, I was an assistant superintendent at 23 years old. I was not an assistant. I hadn't even been an assistant. I was assistant in training. I said, if they offer it and I turn it down, you're going to be mad at me. And he said, I won't be mad at you. Just take the trip. I mean, he like for it. I said, all right, you want me to go take a free trip to Miami? All right. So I did. And again, doing something different. I flew into Miami, went down and visited one of my best friends, Kevin Cavanaugh, owner of Floratine Products Groups, was the assistant superintendent at Indian Creek, went and visited him on South Beach, and Brazil had just won the World Cup and the whole place was a roar. And I drove down to this fantasy island at Card Sound Golf Club inside Ocean Reef Club and was like, wow, you know, answered the questions for these guys just like I would. Like, you know, there's mole crickets eating up a tee. Well, that's easy. We can fix that, right? Yeah. Didn't think anything of it. Got done, got in my car, flew back. And when I landed in Augusta, I got a call from the president of the club and he offered me the job.
Okay.
And, you know, this is 1997 and I was making $9.50 an hour working at Augusta, working hours, unbelievable. And this guy offered me $85,000 plus a $10,000 bonus. And I said, hey, Mr. Smith, I really appreciate the offer, but I'm going to have to decline. And he said, okay. He said, super guy, by the way. He said, Russ, you mind if I ask why? And again, 23-year-old kid, I thought I had to give him an answer right then. I didn't know what I was doing. And I said, well, you know, $10,000 based on performance. What if a hurricane goes through there? How are we going to evaluate that? And he said, okay. He said, how about if we just give it to you, Russ? And I was like, I didn't know what to do because I was trying to get out of it, right? I didn't want anything to do with it. I said, well, geez, whenever I make big decisions in my life, I like to talk through my dad. You mind if I call you tomorrow? He said, absolutely. Take whatever time you need. And I was like, oh, phew. Thank you for giving me time. So I hung up and I called my dad. And my dad's pretty legendary for not telling me what to do, right? He wants me to think for myself and he doesn't want to guide my decisions. And so told him what was going on and told him I declined it. And I still remember this day. He's also pretty legendary for his coaching language, right? And my mom's listening on the phone and he said, you know, Russ, I don't want to tell you what to do with your life. And I'm glad you're happy at Augusta, you know. And he said, I just got to ask you. He said, are you a f***ing idiot?
Okay, we're going to bleep that.
And I started laughing and I said, why? And he said, look, he said, you should do what you want to do with your life. But he said, you know, I worked in Odessa, New York my entire life.
Right.
And he said, that's more money than, you know, I ever made in my whole life. He
that's
said,
you shouldn't
dismiss it. You should really think about it. And I said, no, geez, good thought. You know, I kind of looked at it differently. And I remember going into Brad and telling him what was going on. And I think he was stunned. I mean, the thought of a assistant in training getting offered a job like that, I think he was like, are you kidding me? Like, I think he had some plan to move me up through. And I just basically got to the point where I was like, I can either go take a swing at this right now, or I can wait and go do 6 years as an assistant somewhere. Now let's go do it. Frankly, it's still my favorite place in the planet.
Oh, that's
I love
so interesting. Because
yeah.
Thinking about taking a swing, right? I know that you had wanted to do events. And I imagine, like Courier, it got in your blood at Augusta. I know it got in his blood at Augusta. It gets in your blood. You can't get it out. So now you want to host your own event. It's not going to happen at Card Sound. Is that how Southern Hills got on the map and you did the first PGA there?
Yes. I didn't have to do an event, but I wanted to be at those types of courses. I wanted to be at those classic courses where your work could be evaluated, where people evaluated on a world stage. If they had an event, great. I didn't make a goal of something I couldn't control, whether they could get an event or not. So the greatest thing about Card Sound was that the members there at the time were phenomenal. And I made it very clear to them what my goals were. And I said to them, look, there's 10, 15 courses in the country that if they come open, I would want to go after it. And they would support me for it. They would make the calls. They would help do it, right? Mm-hmm. But I felt like I was a little running into, back then I was really worried about the, you know, you're a Bermuda guy and most of those classic courses were on bent. Yeah. And I really worried that that was going to be a problem. And I don't know if it was as much Bermuda to bent. I do think it was part of it. As much as it was during that window, Mr. Latchaw was filling voids everywhere, right? Yeah. Now, I was business partners with Mr. Latchaw on a project. I was a volunteer for a bunch of his tournaments. I consider him a great friend, mentor. So I had relationships with him, but I hadn't technically worked with him. So whenever those jobs came open and he got the call, Mr. Latchaw would put one name towards him, and it was usually someone who was working for him. So I was struggling to get in the door on some of these interviews and, you know, maybe thought I was better than I was. I don't know. But that was the goal, right? And 7 years into it, I had pretty much come to the conclusion I wasn't going to get those opportunities. And I kind of expressed that to a greens chairman I had down there at the time, and he kind of lit me up and he was like, he said, that's bull, Russ. He said, I believe if you got your goals, you go achieve them. You just got to keep pursuing them.
Just what a coach's son needed to hear to change your thinking on it, right?
Yeah. I mean, we could go on for 2 hours on little moments along the way. One of the stories that's not known, when I first got to Card Sound, we started a project a year later with Brian Silva, who had Corner Silva and Mungin had done the project at the Lynx that I did my internship with Jim Hangle. We were doing a great project and the project was struggling to get completed. The contractor was struggling. And during that window, Mark Machado was at Pebble and he needed an assistant and he was coming into the finishing the amateur and having the open in 2000. And he called me and asked me if I wanted the job. And I told him I did. And I was going to leave Card Sound to go to Pebble Beach and be the assistant. And he needed me there by November. Well, the project was running. I could tell it wasn't going to finish. So I called Mark and I said, hey, how long can you wait? Because this thing's not going to finish. And if I don't finish it, this will kill these guys and I'll never get a job in this industry again. And he said, man, I can't wait. The tournament's in June. And I said, all right, I got to pull out then. Well, my good friend who was then working, I think at Congressional, was Eric Greatalk. He yep. wanted that thing too. Eric ended up going there.
Yep.
And as the superintendent, because yep. Mark goes to Shinnecock and he ends up being a superintendent in 2000. So then pull forward, Eric's now at Wingfoot.
After Mr. Latchaw.
Yeah. And I'm at Card Sound 7+ years in. I'm standing on a green at Muirfield. This is all getting convoluted, working, yes. helping for the tournament.
Well, but it's all that bloodline, right? It's the Latchaw bloodline with the little bit of Schaefer bloodline.
Well, the irony is it gets Sandy Lane and I'm playing on a bunch of names out there. Sandy Lane opens up and at the time was like a, you know, high paying, revered Bermuda grass job right in the islands. And my friend Eric from Wingfoot had been asked about it. And I was like, I can't even get asked about a Bermuda job. And I kind of vented that frustration to Mr. Latchaw while I was standing on the 16th green at Muirfield. And he argued with me on what a great job I had in Florida and that I was making a mistake to jump out of there and I shouldn't leave a great job. And I said, Mr. Latchaw, that's easy for you to say. You've done it. And he said, Mr. Myers, you know, he talks to Mr. Myers, I disagree with you, but I'm going to support you. And I said, I appreciate that. So this is May. I go and this will get you to your half court shot. I've got a weekend trip plan where I go to the Heat game. I shoot a half court shot. I make a $10,000 half court shot. I fly to Bristol, Tennessee, and I go watch the NASCAR race. Then I go up to Muirfield and I work Muirfield or one of those. And I go over to the tournament and I go over to the open at Wingfoot and I'm exhausted and I'm in the tent and Eric Greatalk comes in and he says, hey, Tim Morgan's looking for you. And Tim wants to introduce me to Nick Sidorkis, the general manager of Southern Hills, to talk about John Zielinski had decided he was leaving and going to Charlotte.
Right.
So it's a small web world.
And it's so interesting. Know. So now you get this Southern Hills opportunity, right? The first tournament there was the Open?
PGA.
The PGA Championship. You did two there.
Yes.
We're doing really good making our way through this. In between, I don't want to say a short stint, but you're at Southern Hills for a period of time. priorities start to change. You're not going to NASCAR and the Heat game and all this stuff with a wife and two young kids, I think, if you're prioritizing that, right? So let's get to the LA Country Club thing, right? Because this is now where you bump into, I don't want to say it was probably the only time, but where you now are working with Gil and Jim at LA Country Club. I don't think you had worked with them in your first stint at Southern Hills, yes or no?
Correct. I had never met Gil.
That's what I thought.
Never
so now
met
you're
Jim
in
either,
LA.
Yeah.
Let's make the transition. You're going to LA. Was the redo of LA already decided before you went? And I know Chris and all those guys, you were just so great when you had the Golf Channel interview and you got emotional about it. It was just so great to see how much you cared about it. So was the plan to redo it in the mix when you left to go there? Or was that something that evolved once you were there?
Yeah, they had already done the fairway bunkers. So the LA Country Club project was approved. And my understanding of the story was the contracts were sitting on the general manager's desk the day of the Lehman Brothers collapse. And that morning, one of the board members called the GM and said, hey, have you signed those yet? And he said, not yet. They're on my desk. He said, don't sign them yet. So ultimately, what ended up happening is they were going to stop the project because of potential economic downturn. And Gil and the club got together and decided to keep the momentum going. Let's do the fairway bunkers so we can show them a taste of the work. So they had done that the year prior. Then they still had to do the rest of the work. And my first day on the job, they were starting to install mainline. So I had no planning involvement. Bruce and Gil's crew had done all the budgeting and planning of the project.
So you were just executing it by the time you got there.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think I influenced it more. But the only way I knew of Gil was I had been to visit a really good friend of mine at Plainfield Country Club back in whatever, Greg James. I saw this really cool green that had, you know, a hard corner to it. And I said, man, who was the architect on this? And he said, Gil Hance. And I said, who's that?
Yeah.
I didn't know
Another
who he was.
Good Cornell guy that you bumped into along the way. So listen, tell me a little bit. I want to do a little bit about construction for the folks listening. One of the things I've noticed over the years, especially for historic clubs, they want to see something before they agree to a whole redo. I can't even tell you how many clubs I'm sure have done multiple master plans over the years, you know? You obviously oversaw the bunker project that was all done, but it wasn't really the full redo of the course they ultimately played the Open on, was it?
When I saw it?
Yes.
No, it was, the place was not in great shape, Frankie, and it was stumped down. And the landscape's changed a lot since then. I mean, you had a membership that probably by their own admission struggled to get common support of issues. Everything was, you know, hey, we've got X amount, let's gear it around the amount of money we have instead of around a common vision. Mm-hmm. And I think Gil and Jim's master plan, working with Jeff Shackelford on it, set a goal. Mm-hmm. And then it was about building confidence around there that it was exciting and it was going to come out right. And you had a membership that was used to certain lackluster playing conditions and no clarity. So we started to build on that. And first question I asked Gil when I met him was, hey, name me five things that were pulled out of this project in the master planning that we need to get back into it. Hmm. Because I think I'm going to have opportunities to fight for those and to make them happen, but I need to know what they are. Hmm. And I think in the moment, my read on Gil was, he was like, yeah, whatever, you know, that's never going to happen. But I kept pressing him and he pointed to a series of trees between the first and the 18th hole. And he said, well, those would be a good start. And they were down 4 days later.
Okay.
And when he came back out, I said, hey, you got to give me more and you got to give it faster or we're going to miss the opportunities. And he did. And I think that started to build some enthusiasm that, hey, we could get the full vision done as we built momentum. And we had a great group of members that were built around this thing and it just kept going.
Okay.
You know?
So listen, now you said a lot without saying very much there. You know, when you're into a job, right, you just got hired from Southern Hills. You had done a tournament, right? LA is a classic now. It's a sort of iconic after the Open there. I think always thought of as such, but I would agree. I had visited it over the years and it certainly needed updating or facelifting like many places have done where vegetation's not been managed as aggressively as it could. And I would include trees in that vegetation thing. But what you said was, I can fight for these things. I can get these things. What was it about working with the membership that gave you that, I don't want to say leverage, let's just call it influence. What was it that got you that trust that you felt like you could bring things back in Gil's vision that maybe even he thought, as you expressed, couldn't get done?
Look, I don't know what the perfect game. Let me tell you a quick one. I'll try not to go too long. For years, people would tell me, man, you're a really good superintendent, like members. And I didn't know, like, the course is great. And I couldn't define what it was they thought about it was great. Like, if somebody asked me what I do better, I didn't know what it was. I just knew what I was doing in front of me. That didn't look right. I'm going to fix it. The debris there shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know why. I couldn't define what a good superintendent was. And when I look at LA, I would say, I hope that people trusted me because I meant what I said and I had integrity to it. And I wasn't trying to mislead anybody. I'll give you the truth to both sides of the argument. Even if I'm telling you to go one way, I'll give you the other side of the argument. Mm-hmm. So I'm being genuine. Yes, I want them to be the one to make the decision, but I think they know that if they don't go the way I'm telling them they should, that I'm probably going to be finding a different place to execute a vision.
Okay.
And I'm not threatening them, but it's like, look, here's the pros and cons. This is why I think we should go this way. I'd like you to support it. I can't do it. I know the limitations of the superintendent.
Yeah.
I can't go unilaterally tell a club you need to pull all your golf carts off a golf course. Because membership is going to say, well, we own this golf course. We need to define it. So I need to build that support of the people because the vision is always coming from the board members. I got to convince them of what that vision is. The good news was I was just having to convince them of what Gil's vision was.
That's right. And they had already bought into it on some
exactly.
level. And listen, we're going to buy into one more little conversation right after this message, Russ. I'm with Russ Myers of Hance Golf Course Design. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. We'll be right back. Delivering your products accurately and with precision requires smart spray technology. The professional spray tech folks at Frost Spray Technology have the right equipment available now to meet your needs. Sustainable management requires efficient product applications to make your spray day a great day. Learn more about precision applications from Frost Spray Technologies at frostserve.com. That's Frost, S-E-R-V.com. Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm with Russ Myers, who we wrapped up talking about your work at LA Country Club and how obviously you were able to help Gil and the club realize his vision. I'm sure that endeared you guys to each other, which you then must have brought that relationship. And as we talked about offline and in the interest of time, when you went back to Southern Hills, and I'm assuming a personal decision as much as a professional decision. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't guide the decision. I said to him up front, listen, you know, I love Gil, but my recommendation to the club, and Gil did support it, was they should reach out to Bill and Ben because Bill and Ben had done the West Nine. They had a connection to the club. They did. Bill and Ben, to my understanding, you know, said, look, we're too busy and, you know, you should talk to Gil or something. And that's kind of what got us there. I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously I wanted to work with Gil and Jim, but again, back to the previous comment, I'm being honest with you people. I would love to work with Gil, but we shouldn't do this based on what I want. The club's identity right now is a little more tied to Bill and Ben if you want to go that way.
Okay. And this is Southern Hills.
Yeah, that's Southern Hills.
Okay, so that's very interesting because, of course, having worked with Gil and Jim, they will talk about how friendly they are with Cor Crenshaw, right? And they mm-hmm. will talk about the growing number, like Doak is in that group of people, Kyle Phillips, you know, there's all sorts of people now that are working in this thing. And, of course, we're having these conversations, Russ, because golf's doing good, brother. pandemic and everything's really picked up golf. But let's talk a little bit. I actually don't want to spend too much time talking about the second stint at Southern Hills, only mm-hmm. to the extent to which somehow it dawned on you, you needed to do something different again. After having a pretty good gig, right? After, you know, not wanting to leave Augusta, right? And then not wanting to leave, go to Card Sound and not wanting to go somewhere else. So I'm wondering about what came over you at some point in Southern Hills, right? You did the redesign, you did the redo with Gil and Jim, you hosted the tournament. Was that enough? And you're like, okay, now I'm ready for something else.
I think it happened years earlier. I think I knew I had gotten everything personally I wanted out of being a superintendent probably 10 years earlier. But when you're handed the opportunity to go to LA Country Club and do that project, when you're handed the opportunity, by the way, to sign up for a US Open, the first one ever at LA Country Club, when you're handed the opportunity to host a senior PGA and a PGA at Southern Hills and to do a project with Gil, it's tough to go, yeah, I'm going to walk away. And so when it got beyond the PGA, there was change happening. My longtime dear friend, great general manager, Nick Sidorkis, was retiring. We had come off of COVID. We had come off of staffing challenges that everybody knows about. And I was in a situation where I now was looking to the end of what was driving the future for me. And I had two young kids, great kids I love, embedded in a school. It was, how do I get to 10 years of that? And it just wasn't what was dry. I think I knew I was done. I just hadn't walked away from it. And I didn't know what the alternative was. Mm-hmm. And there's a funny story to this. I won't try not to go too long because I know we're short on time. But Jim Wagner and I would talk from time to time about general stuff. And about 6 months earlier, he had made a comment to me that he had kind of come to the conclusion they were going to need to hire somebody. Mm-hmm. And I thought they were looking for like some young guy, come grind it out with them, making, you know, starting wage type of thing. So I was like, well, what are you looking for in this? And tried to think of who I could come up with to help him. Couldn't come up with anybody off the cuff. So we kind of moved on. And sometime after that, the irony is Southern Hills had engaged the West Nine project, which Gil has designed a reversible routing for to keep the Core Crenshaw routing and then do a reversible of his. And they had that tag to do it. And they asked me to call and see if we backed it up a year, how it would mess up Jim and Gil's schedule. So I called Jim and he didn't answer. And he called me back and it was a cold day. I was sitting in my office, didn't have anything to do. I was watching CNBC or something or reruns of Friends. And Jim says, hey, Russ, what's going on in Tulsa? And I was totally being flippant and joking. I said, there's nothing going on here today. I said, when are you guys going to find something interesting I can come do with you guys? And he goes, it's funny you say that.
Yeah.
And we started talking about this thing. And I said, Jim, let's not joke through it. Let's be serious about it for a minute. And we asked a few questions. Boom. And by the end of the conversation, I said, all right, I want to do this. What's the next step? And he said, well, look, it's Gil's company. I need to talk to him and I want to do it in person. And I didn't know if this was going to take 2 years, 2 months, whatever. Right?
Yeah.
So getting to the end of it, I have a lake house up at this beautiful lake in Oklahoma that I was at on a Friday night. And I got the classic summer text from about three of our summer college kids saying, hey, I'm going to be leaving 2 weeks early. And I just kind of put my phone down frustrated. And then the next morning I woke up and two of our weekend staff weren't coming in that day. And I was just like, just worn out, right?
You know what they say? Back in the day, you know, when people would have like emotional breakdowns, which I've had in my career, they say it's not the big thing, right? It's not like a death or your car accident. It's like a broken shoelace. It's like that dumb little thing, which of course, employees not fulfilling a commitment that you rely on as a superintendent, no matter how young or old they are, now you got to somehow figure out how to get the stuff done that they're not going to get done.
I knew at the time to get that operation back to where I wanted it to be post-COVID, because look, we accepted a lot of things through COVID and operations, but to get it back as a coach would, I couldn't leave that to my assistant coaches. I was going to have to do it. And frankly, my life was more comfortable than it was 10 years earlier. Hydronics under my greens. I didn't have to worry about greens. And I knew that meant I was going to be sacrificing more time with my family, more time at the weekends on the lake. And I didn't want to do it. And I came to that realization that I was either going to be frustrated by a substandard operation in my own eyes, or I was going to find something else. And it just, the timing worked. And now I hope this works for Jim and Gil so that, you know, I can keep doing this.
Okay, I'm sure it is, because I don't think they would suffer you. And if you were, but also, you know, listen, they're busy. And I think when it comes to your role, that's a thing that they know, even Wagner will admit, to not wanting to be that involved. And that's why they really, I think, very much evaluate the superintendent, right? Wouldn't you say you guys are thinking about the person at the property that you're either going to build or redo, how critical that person is to their success? Because they're only there for a short period of time. And part of realizing that vision, Russ, is having somebody like you and Chris at LA Country Club who sort of know what they're doing to make sure it's maintained that way. It's not as glamorous status of a gig, but still no less important, right?
Yeah, I mean, their best projects through time have been an integration with superintendents. And, you know, sometimes it's because the superintendent's that good. Sometimes it's because the structure of how the club goes about it allows the superintendent to be really good. You know, you can have a great superintendent, but if the club doesn't comprehend how Gil and Jim build, there's too many decisions where they take away. I mean, everything is a soft map of how they're going to go about it. And it's not getting built till they're in the field. And they have that understanding and that trust. They've got to trust that their superintendent is going to represent them well. And they've got to trust that Gil and Jim and our organization are going to use their resources right, because it's not a CAD file. It's not a dimensions like a building that you can go break down. And what I spend a lot of time doing now is having those conversations well before a project, trying to get that stuff out in front. Because the pace at which the work went the last 15 years and the demands on Jim and Gil's time probably pulled their ability to have those dialogues as much with people. So when they get with the right client, they know that's how they work. That's fine. But the ones that don't have that, you can struggle with those things.
You know, it's funny because when I had Jim on recently, we were talking about Ladera and talking about the importance of an owner or a membership or the person or the people involved in formulating the vision that you influence and support and then execute. So you're sitting in the middle a lot right now. As we wrap up, I want to do a little thought exercise since you brought it up, right? You're sitting in your position now. What really is very interesting, much like a coach, right? Coach nowadays is very much interacting with the front office, with the analysts, right? The data-driven stuff, and then having to communicate that to the players, right? In a way that they can understand. So now you put the cryogenic system in at Southern Hills, right? I want you to talk, well, I know a little bit about sort of how you'd approach something like that in the shoes you're in now versus the way you did when you were the superintendent there, you know, wanting to get to your lake house a little bit.
Yeah, it's a good question. Look, I was thinking about your team analogy. The difference with the Hance team is we got two Supermax players on our NBA roster.
That's right. Two Jimmy Butlers.
No trade clauses either, right? So you may think you got the greatest plan to go beat that team, but if they don't want to run that play, you're not running it. So you have to kind of, to your point, you have to be in the between and understand what's happening and where your role is. If my role is to, you know, we got a whole group of guys who want to do great stuff, but it's always kind of got to have that sign off of LeBron.
So how do you get something like that very unique sort of system? That doesn't even seem like a system that a golfers or architects would know much about. So talk a little bit about that, because I hear this sometimes. I've been very close to a lot of really good superintendents I won't name who've said to me, you know, Frank, I don't know if it's worth it or not, but it's the latest and greatest. And I feel like, you know, we wouldn't be doing the club service if I didn't at least put it in and give them the option to use X, Y, or Z, whatever the technology is. In this case, it was the cryogenic or the hydronic systems. Mm-hmm. What is your thought about that in general, feeling like you got to put it in because it's state of the art versus really believing it's going to make a difference? Because just so everybody knows, I understand that the cooling of these things made a big difference for you.
Made a huge difference.
Yeah.
Listen, I think there's certain sites that need it and would benefit from it. An example would be if you go into the Dallas, Texas market right now with Bentgrass and you don't put it in, you're going to be one of the courses that doesn't have it, and you're not going to be able to compete with quality of surfaces through the summer months. It's that simple. Now, if your golf play is not geared, or if you're, I mean, Augusta National is ironic, their golf season's not geared around it. So do they have to have it? No, not really. They can survive the summers without it. Mm-hmm. Now, they're bad on other things like nematodes, where it maybe helps them survive the summer and start the season better. Mm-hmm. But I think you just look at each situation. The question is, you know, Gil and Jim are in a unique spot where they take on work they want to take on. But my question would be, if you don't understand Gil's vision and Jim's vision and how they like to build, you probably shouldn't work with them. Because if you want to come in and do every last bell and whistle just to do it, they deep down see that as unnecessary and frugal. And it actually detracts from their own brand of what they're trying to do for the game of golf. So each situation is different. It's fair, right?
I tell you, Russ, that you did a really good job of politically navigating that very difficult question. And I guess I'd say this. After all these months, right, you are working with these people that, you know, have a certain way they go about it. And I, you know, get an inside look because I've worked with them as well. And one of the things Jim's talked to me about that I'm sure has got to be a little bit of a challenge is sometimes because they're very, I would say, creative and now have a fair amount of license in their work, they don't always know exactly how it's going to turn out in the field. I'm wondering, in so far as you can in the first 14, 15 months of the many varied projects you've worked on, are there sometimes things where they want to do something where, yeah, how about we try this? Or Jim openly admits at some point he's going to make a creative decision and the superintendent's life is going to be a little bit trickier growing grass in this spot. Your thoughts about sometimes staying out of those positions?
Yeah, it's a hard one to define. I'll tell you right now, we're doing two projects that are somewhat similar, right? One in Florida, one in Texas. One had Eric Greatalk as the on-site representative of the club for the last 2 years, right? So every project management decision, he's guided. The other didn't have a superintendent until July. So I was guiding those. So we're building the Florida project out of on-site sand that was dug out of the reservoir. We're piling up on the green and we're shaping it in a finished grade. It's not a USGA. We're not excavating anything, building a USGA structure. And the other is got excavating out 14 and a half inches of pure sand, by the way, that most golf courses in the world would think is great sand to grow on. And it's putting in a specialty greens mix to grow it on it. That's guidance of the ownership, right? That's Eric defining that he thinks that's important for how those greens are going to perform, dealing with the stresses he's going to deal with there. Maybe I led the guy, me and he, Jim and I gave the guy a harder time, but you know, they're different on different decisions and maybe we gave them a better time. We don't really know. We're ultimately trying to create the most cost-effective way to create a natural golf environment that gets the ball on the ground, gets it bouncing and lets it play the way Gil and Jim have a vision.
There you go. And I tell you, having worked with them and now I, you know, listening to you talk, one of the things from my years of working with them, I appreciated was Jim was very process, protocol, spec oriented, right? Especially because of his connection to the caveman and the construction end of the thing, right? There always was this process that was more important than everything else. And I think once you do that, much like in a team sport, and here we are again, teams play particular ways. They play best when they play to each other's strengths, right? And I think that's what that team seems to have down pat pretty well, because it's not just about designing the golf course. It's about, you know, bringing it about. And I don't think most people would think this about Jim, but he is on the frugal side. He doesn't want to pay more or, you know, right. Just because they're hot and fancy, he doesn't want to pay more for anything if he thinks it's wasteful. So that must really appeal to your psyche and values as well.
Yeah, I try not to worry about it. I try to execute on whatever we're trying to do. It's an interesting thing you just laid out because I need to try to lay it all out almost like on a spreadsheet and try to evaluate it and then constantly reevaluate it, right? And that's kind of what you're talking about. Jim's more structured and I'm probably that way just from my superintendent days. I'm not as structured as some guys, right? You know, there's guys all over who've got dates collected. But the more you impart that structure to Gil, the less creative and more frustrated he seems to be, right? So you have to find that balance. You can't, I send Gil emails. He doesn't even respond, right? Because he doesn't even want to get in those weeds. Where Jim and I talk four or five times a week. And I think it's just because we like to tell each other funny stories. It's kind of been that way since LA. I still can picture Jim at LA in the excavator turning sideways and opening the door and putting his head in his hands and going, you know, what is that idiot doing? You know, that's kind of that dialogue with him. So that's that dynamic. And there's times where I want to use data to explain things to Gil. But what you realize with Gil, and the other thing I would say to everybody who gets nervous about the clients is these guys have been doing this for a long time and they really haven't failed anybody.
No.
And at some point, you got to realize their record speaks for itself. And I can provide all the new data and whatever I need. Gil's going to look at me and go, hey, I got 30 years of doing this that I know where we're at.
That's
you know
right.
what I mean?
All right, listen, well, Russ, I know where we're at, and we're at the end, brother. Thanks very much for taking the time. What a joy to wander through these paths with you. This has been a really excellent conversation, and one I'm so thrilled to end our 11th season on, Russ. Thanks for taking the time, Pat.
Hey, thanks for having me, Frank. Stay warm up there.
All right, thanks a lot. Russ Myers, Hance Golf Design. I'm Frank Rossi. This is Frankly Speaking. Thank you for joining us. Big thanks to Russ Myers of Hance Golf Course Design. Frankly Speaking, part of the TurfNet family of podcasts, is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts, leave us a review. Frankly Speaking is in its 11th season, and we thank our major sponsors, Frostbray Technologies, Dryject Services, and the Plant Food Company, for the support that makes us possible. Take a minute and explore what they have to offer. Frankly Speaking is produced at Rep Studios in downtown Ithaca, New York, by Nate Richardson, with artwork and music by Nicole and Tucker Rossi, support from Peter McCormick, John Kiger, and John Reitman. I'm Frank Rossi. Thank you for joining us.